This episode is brought to you by Pine Melon. Pine Melon is a next-generation grocery delivery app that partners with over 200 local farmers, ranchers, and producers in Colorado to help make fresh, locally sourced foods available to the Denver community at fair prices. And this month, Pine Melon is celebrating Earth Month by highlighting their commitment to sustainability. They keep their supply chain efficient to help reduce carbon emissions and offer same-day delivery to help reduce food waste. And as a special thanks to CityCast listeners, you can use the code CityCastDenver for $75 off your first order. That's Pine Melon, the farmer's market delivered.
Today on CityCast Denver. The great fentanyl debate of 2022 is finally over. Going into the state legislative session back in January, everyone agreed that we needed to do something to stem the rising tide of overdose deaths.
For years, illicit fentanyl was found almost exclusively east of the Mississippi. But recently, it has arrived in Colorado.
Our lawmakers negotiated for months, and in the end, thanks to a last-minute compromise, we got a bill that further criminalizes people who use drugs.
According to our partners at the Denver Gazette, there was only an hour left at the end of the session when the final vote approving this bill came down.
We made a priority of covering this fight on the show. So me and Paul are looking back at how it all went down and talking about what's next. Oh, and just a note, there's some adult language in this episode because I'm pretty upset about it. Today is Tuesday, May 17th, 2022. I'm Bree Davies, and this is CityCast Denver.
No, I'm not stressed. Just ready. Just getting ready. Readying my lungs, because I think the next thing to do is just to start recording.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right, do you want to welcome me? Should I welcome you? What do you think?
Just welcome each other.
Bree, welcome to your show. Good morning.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you for joining me on my show. That's also your show, to be fair.
Well, thank you, Bree. And it's my pleasure to be here because we're talking about the fentanyl bill. And it's something we've both really cared about through this whole legislative session all spring. And it passed last week, I think, just at the very last minute. And this bill got chopped up and all changed around. And there's a ton of stuff in there. And I want to go through all of it. But I think the big headline is that it would make possessing less than a gram of fentanyl a misdemeanor and possessing more than a gram a felony. That actually moves down the threshold from where it was previously set at 4 grams. So this new bill is going to mean more felonies. And it's kind of interesting because the day after this bill was passed, you were at a fundraiser for the Harm Reduction Action Center. Where I imagine people had some pretty strong feelings about all this. And I want to start there. Tell me all about it. What was that like? What was the scene like?
Yeah, I mean, it was like so totally coincidental that that happened. It's their annual, you know, spring fundraiser. There were so many people there, hundreds of people there. And the room was energized for sure, but people were also pissed because the way that this bill unfolded, it could have been a big win that the room was celebrating, but it wasn't. Several folks from the Harm Reduction Action Center spoke to the group about the work they do every day, where your money goes, the details of what they fund with the money that you give, which is like safer smoking kits for people that smoke drugs, you know, safe disposal for needles, street outreach, care, all sorts of things that they take care of. But then at the end of all of these really beautiful speeches about the work that they do, Lisa Rayville got up and kind of said what I think so many of us were feeling, which was, fuck, this sucks. The fentanyl accountability bill, the biggest thing it did was further criminalize drugs. And that by default further criminalizes people who use drugs. And she was just kind of like, she didn't call out anybody specifically, but it was like, there's some people in the legislature that call themselves harm reductionists, and this was not a harm reduction bill. And I will say that's one of the things about the actual bill language that is weird to me, is there is a lot of use of the term harm reduction in there, but it's not harm reduction principles. Hmm. Harm reduction is reducing the harms associated with drugs. You know, like it's reducing the harms associated with anything that is dangerous. So in the harm reduction space for drug use, harm reduction means providing people with clean supplies so that they don't get things like hepatitis and HIV. It's to keep people who use drugs alive. And so this bill does not do that, as far as I can tell. And Lisa's frustration was so palpable. I mean, she was angry. And I think in part because the numbers and the work that the Harm Reduction Action Center and groups like them across the world have been doing show that criminalizing people that use drugs does not stop the drug problem. It doesn't get more drugs off the street. It puts people in jail, and it doesn't necessarily put even a dent in our opioid crisis or right now our fentanyl crisis. As we've criminalized it, it's only gotten worse. So...
well,
it sucked.
You're saying this stuff about harm reduction and criminalization, and I hear Representative Leslie Harrod's voice in my head talking about all of these great things that got in this bill, and like I think she would say that she believes in harm reduction principles as the main way to approach this problem, and she would talk about how proud she is of like the funding for testing strips and naloxone, and I don't know. I mean, isn't that harm reduction, or is it just that these aspects are not compatible with each other, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, Paul. I think it's that they're not compatible. I spoke with Lisa Rayville about this, and she kind of said the same. Like, what it comes down to is that this bill would increase punishments for people who use drugs. So you can hand out testing strips and fund outreach programs all you want, but we won't necessarily be keeping people alive today or keeping them out of jail.
This episode is brought to you by the Museum of Outdoor Arts. Because on Sunday, April 28th, the museum is hosting La Primavera Festival, a celebration of spring, to kick off event season at Marjory Park. La Primavera Festival is a family-friendly event inspired in part by the Gaelic Bealtaine celebration and European May Day, marking the beginning of summer. And the star of the show is really something special. They're premiering the latest permanent installation by local artist Lonnie Hansen. It's called The Cabinet of Curiosities and Impossibilities. Hansen describes it as an enchanting homage to English curio shops, featuring a collection of relics from fairy tales and nursery rhymes that tell stories about early optics, geometry, magical tools, celestial wonders, and more. The festival includes a pancake brunch, live Celtic music, maypole dancing, flower crown and basket making, yard games, and a bar for adult beverages. Tickets are available now at moaonline.org. That's moaonline.org. I want to talk about one aspect of this, just like the way that it went down. Like this issue specifically, how it got processed through our politics. Because I feel like this is just such a classic example of we have a problem, we have to do something. And then everybody brings their own ideas and their own bias to the table, and then it ends up approaching like a million different things, all in kind of a bad way. Like just no real leadership displayed. There was no like single strategy. And I feel like that was Governor Polis's responsibility here. Like he always said like he's going to sign the bill. He likes this, not that, this part, not that, but he never offered like, here's the approach we're going to take. Like we're going to take a harm reduction approach and then make every aspect of the bill fall from that. Not we're going to glom together these different things. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think a huge part of this issue stems from the fact that medical professionals, harm reductionists, people that use drugs were not part of that initial conversation to craft this bill. So the folks that are on the ground every day working on this issue were not consulted. And when it comes to things like drugs, they're highly stigmatized and the responses often criminalize this out of existence. And that to me was the approach of this bill. No matter how much there was talk about mental health services or funding for fentanyl testing strips or funding for naloxone. I mean, those things are great in theory, but if the overarching like arm of this bill is to criminalize people, none of that shit matters. And that to me was the problem, Paul, was that that's been the mindset for, I don't know, however long the war on drugs has been going on, the better part of a century. Mm-hmm. And we have shown over and over again that it's not changing. I mean, if it was effective, we wouldn't be seeing fentanyl deaths year over year getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
We would be losing less people. So that to me is part of the problem was, A, there wasn't leadership in there with lived experience, data, firsthand knowledge, and the criminalization aspect was kind of saturated this whole conversation. Yeah. And the bill, the ultimate bill.
Law enforcement has a lot of influence in that building, I think. Yes. That's something I learned from this. A lot of influence.
And there was a lot of testimony. I mean, I think there was like 14 hours of testimony or something about it. And a lot of law enforcement talked more about further criminalization, which was interesting to me because I think about that conversation I had with Attorney General Phil Weiser. And I remember he talked to, it was like a sheriff or someone that oversaw a jail in a rural part of Colorado. And he said like 90% of the folks in jail were withdrawing. And I was like, why do you want to be in that business? Yeah. Why do... Police don't want to be in the business of helping folks through this process. I've told this story over and over again. I've helped somebody withdraw at home from heroin. It's a nightmare. I just don't understand why police officers would want to be part of that.
Well, you've seen this cycle before. You know, this is kind of my first time paying attention to this issue, really. But, you know, you were there when the 2019 bill was getting passed. You've seen this before. What's next? What can we expect?
More people are going to die, unfortunately. Until we tackle those root issues that get people into these situations with drugs, like housing stability. This isn't just an unhoused person's issue. I want to be clear about that. This is not just the unhoused community, but it is. It's all over. I mean, drugs are everywhere. And until we really deal with the fact that we need things to be safe to keep people alive in order for them to deal with their stuff, we're just going to see more death. And I think with this bill, we're going to see more incarceration. And anytime you incarcerate a person, you remove them from their community. And that's a chain reaction problem that can ruin someone's life, their ability once they get out of jail to do things like get housing, get a job, reintegrate into society, into their community with their family. I mean, we ruin people's lives when we put them in jail, and it just seems very counterintuitive to me to put people who use drugs in jail. As far as like legislatively, I don't know what it will look like in a couple years. But again, what will most likely, unfortunately, happen is we'll have another slew of very high profile deaths, and that will again spring lawmakers into action. And what they do from there, I don't know. I hope that they listen to harm reductionists and people who use drugs and medical professionals who deal with this every day, and we do something different, but it doesn't look like that's going to be the case.
Well, as we're wrapping up, I want to offer one small silver lining to this. I just was reading about fentanyl in general, there was a quote from something posted on the Colorado Health Institute website about just what has been happening the last couple of years around this. And this article states, and I'm quoting, "Drug overdose deaths were already on the rise in Colorado, but the COVID-19 pandemic had an unprecedented impact on substance use and access to treatment and support options." So, yes, drug overdose deaths were already on the rise around the same time fentanyl was coming in, but the pandemic created the conditions for despair that led people to make bad decisions, I think. And the pandemic is slowly, God willing, going away. So hopefully the fabric of our community and our economy can, you know, stitch itself back together a little bit.
And I do want to say, throughout the pandemic, the Harm Reduction Action Center did not close. They were open. They're all their normal hours. They were still serving the community of people who use drugs every day through the pandemic, regardless of what was going on. So I want to give props to them for sticking it out and just doing what they do. I also know, as someone in recovery, isolation is like one of the easiest ways to get to a darker place. And so being close with each other again, I think you're right. I hope that that helps. I also just want to say one thing. We talk about this a lot. Supervised use sites, which are places where people can safely use drugs and they are not alone and there are medical professionals there. If you don't want to see people doing drugs in your alley, if you don't want to see people doing drugs at Union Station, if you don't want to see people doing drugs in your favorite park, advocate for supervised use sites. It gives people a place to do that. And then you don't see it anymore. If you don't like it, you don't have to see it. And these people can stay alive and mind their own business just as you would like to mind your own business. So it's just my last little PSA for supervised use.
No, I love that. I love that. I hope the future holds more conversations about supervised use sites.
Me too.
Maybe some state lawmakers who are frustrated by this whole experience and eager to, you know, maybe move to a different office might want to talk about that stuff with us. We'd love to talk about that.
I would love it. I would love it. I love talking about supervised use. Let's do it. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me on my show, Paul, to talk about my get on my soapbox about my thing.
I love learning from you on this issue, Bree. Thank you so much for sharing, as always.
And here's what else Denverites are talking about. The Denver Art Museum has officially removed another piece of looted artwork from its collection. The Denver Post reports that one of the famous Benin bronzes, an artifact stolen from southern Nigeria by British colonizers, was given to the dam in the 1950s. This is the first step to repatriating the pilfered art. It's also part of a larger movement of art museums across the world acknowledging what it means to show off stolen goods like you own them. And finally, Paul tells me the Avalanche are facing off against the St. Louis Blues in Game 1 of the second round of the playoffs at Ball Arena tonight. The Avs' starting goalie Darcy Kuemper had to miss a game after a gnarly eye injury, but the good word is he'll be back between the pipes tonight. The puck drops at 7:30 p.m. I hope you can see it. That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. If you enjoyed the show, why not take a minute to tell a friend about us? Rate the show wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to our morning newsletter, where today Peyton goes deeper on the stolen artwork conversation. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more news from around the city. Bye-bye. The Avs starting goalie Darcy Kuemper. His name is Darcy? Huh. That's a man's name? God.